Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Carr, whose memoir is titled The Night of the Gun. David Carr is currently a business reporter and blogger for the New York Times, has worked at several publications over the years. This memoir concerns his addiction and escape from addiction, or getting over addiction, and his work as a reporter. In so doing, what sets this book apart from other memoirs about drug addiction and the dark night of the soul and the dawn that comes afterward is that David Carr used his expertise as a reporter to contact the people that came along with him on the journey and interviewed them with video and camera and with microphone to find out the difference between his own memory and what really happened. What kept occurring to me in reading the book is that the subtext of the book is not about addiction, it's not about reporting, it's about the nature of memory.
Yeah, the gesture of the book is, as you smartly point out, is that old sort of arc of abasement followed by recovery is, you know, that's fairly routine. What I remembered about it, I think, is less important than what actually happened. I think we all tend to shave corners in the past in a way that suits us. And I wanted to go back and really look and find out exactly, precisely what happened. And so I, you know, did 60 interviews on videotape and pulled a lot of probably 2,000 pages of documents, police, medical, and started to correlate it against what I remembered.
How easy was it or hard was it at various times to separate out David Carr, the person, from David Carr, the reporter?
I would say my affect when I was out doing it was as a journalist, but I'm talking to people who I knew very well 20 years before, and if you think of some of the people in your past that you'd least like to see, walking into them and saying, you know that scab on your shoulder that I put there 20 years ago? I was about you tear that off, and we talk about it. Oh, do you mind if I videotape you while we do it? It was a little embarrassing.
Were there people who absolutely refused to talk to you?
I was married to a woman when I was 23 years old who would have been an important person in the book. She's a fair-minded person. She has a great memory. She's very even-keeled, and I can remember driving 70 miles from Minneapolis. I'd flown there out to where she was, and having her just look at me and say, you know, I backed you up out of my life 25 years ago, happily so, and I'd just soon leave it there.
Have you had any word from her since the book has come out? Any regrets that she wasn't in it?
No, that wouldn't be her way, actually. I mean, I've heard from a lot of people who are in the book. Most all of them saw it before it came out. I will have experiences like I was in Portland at a live radio performance, and somebody slipped me a note from an old friend that was waiting for me outside. You know, the most common question from people is not what I said about them in the book, but more about why they're not in there.
But, of course, that means that your memory was selective in terms of who you chose and who you felt was important,
right,
which is an element of memory itself.
Yes, I do think we assemble those parts, you know, it isn't just the mortar of sort of cognition, putting things together, but it's also very much the bricks you choose. I can remember there was one woman in the book, in retrospect, she would have been a valuable addition to the book, but I really could not bear the thought of going to see her. And so when the publisher said this chapter about this woman doesn't seem absolutely essential to the narrative, I was partly relieved because I didn't really want to go back and see her.
This was one of the girlfriends that came and went?
She's a fairly renowned writer at this point and comes from a writerly family. We were both in recovery, and we had an exceedingly complicated relationship that if I tried to describe to you, she would most certainly say it was dead wrong, and I had it all wrong, so yeah, they didn't feel she really added to that. Unlike a lot of books, this was a thoroughly edited and vetted book. It got a big first edit from Ruth Feschel at Simon & Schuster, and then David Rosenthal, who's the editor-in-chief, went through and put about 400 stickies in the manuscript that I had to see to as well.
I noticed that you only use first names throughout the book. So some people are, at least to me, fairly obvious. Tom Arnold is clearly Tom Arnold. Kurt Anderson, it's clearly Kurt Anderson. Jason from the New York Times, we know that too. Did you disguise any first names too?
There's two pseudonyms in the book. One is a woman who goes by a nickname, Dooley, and she's married to someone who is a very public person, and she felt it would be bad for her husband's career to be in this book. So we made an agreement to have her proceed by pseudonym. I just did an event in Chicago, and I looked up and was surprised to see her sitting there. That was a nice closing of the loop. And then there was another guy where I had sent him the book, the finished manuscript, and he said, one, I hate books like this. Two, I hate how you described you and I feel as if you've left out every good part of our relationship. And three, I don't want my kids to really know or think this was me. So he got a pseudonym as well.
People would know who you're talking about one way or the other if they were involved in your life.
Very much so. And there's been a literary parlor game in Minnesota about who is who and who did what to whom. And I didn't do it to be cute. I used it partly as a way of trying not to throw people under a bus or alter their lives. It's a convention in programs of recovery. You only use people's first name, and I thought that was a trope that I would adopt somewhat conveniently. And even if people are sort of known to those who know, it gives them deniability, and they can say that was another Richard or that was another Marcia.
The mother of your twins, Anna, has been given a blurb on your website, and that, I guess, came out after the book. Did she request that?
When she read the book, she would say, this was different, that was different. And I said, I do not want to argue with you. Whatever you think happened, whatever was different, just write it down. And I'll either put it on the website or put it in the paperback. And that blurb is what she finally committed to paper. And I think it adds sort of significant value. She's had a very complicated relationship both with me and with this book. For a while, she was okay with it. Then I think she hated it. We were talking a great deal for a while, and now we're no longer talking. She was afraid it would interrupt her relationship with our daughters that we have in common. It actually brought them together. It helped them understand a lot more because she had been cast as the villain over and over in sort of their minds or their history. And I think the book did a good job of explaining to them that it was a complicated time and everybody did the best they could.
Well, I noticed that you took very great care to distinguish between your own view, which is that you were the only one who could raise the twins, to her view, which was in essence that you stole them. And that's pretty clear throughout the book, those two views.
I just love that you picked up on that. It's not a significant literary epiphany. It isn't in a narrative sense. But in my view, I had sort of bought into her, just for the benefit of your readers, when I was using, I ended up tangled up with this drug dealer named Anna, and we probably would have split apart fairly soon, but she got pregnant and had these twins, and it sort of knit us together. And then I eventually sobered up, and she didn't. And she had maintained all along that I had stole them. When I looked at the court record, I thought, no, I kind of see you in here handing them to me hand over fist. But then the weird part is I had always thought, well, it was an easy decision for the court to make. I must have postured as kind of a very fat sort of baby Jesus. Just as a courtesy, I went to see my family lawyer from then. It was the funniest. There's videotape of it on the website, nightlegun.com, where she's trying to explain to me just how unsuitable I was. In her nice Minnesota way, she's like, you were really fat. And you didn't smell very good. And she more or less described a street person. So it was one of a number of times where I had always sort of motored along thinking a certain thing. that upon investigation didn't turn out to be true.
But at the same time, you did put the girls into a foster home for a while, and of course your parents were there to help as well. I mean, it wasn't as if you were living in a vacuum, except when you left them in the car.
Right. I think we can get back to that. But I think one of the lessons is of the book is that being white and coming from, I didn't come from a money background, but I came from a middle class background. I had an education. I had an existing family support structure. And all those things, I think, kept me out of consequence from the many other people. I think if I was black and I came from a different part of town, I think I would have ended up in jail for a long, long time. And there wouldn't be any job at the New York Times. There wouldn't be any book tour, and I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you.
Well, you got several breaks down the road where people always were willing to give you a chance over and over and over again because you were a dogged investigative reporter.
I think that has something to do with geography. I think the fact that this book reflects a lot of things about Minnesota. One is that there's a lot of treatment centers there, and I sampled many of them. Two is there's a kind of endless sort of decency or reflexive forgiveness there where people were willing to give me shot after shot. And then three is I don't think you could have done the reporting in New Jersey where I live, because if you think about it, people have this reflex to be nice and to engage. And I was showing up to ask them something preposterous, and you could tell they thought it was weird. You could just hear them when I closed the door, oh, that David Carr, he's such a weird one. What do you think he's up to? I'm glad he moved to New York. You can sort of hear it. So I think the geography of the book is sort of reflecting the fact that I got a lot of different chances and was able to go back and ask these very, I don't know, a group that's sort of well-mannered as a culture and nice as a culture. They see Minnesota nice to help me with this book, and most did.
You bring up the point that had you been black, you would not have gotten those chances. You probably would have wound up in jail. All along, the fact that you were a white guy in an environment with a lot of black people who don't have the same opportunities as you have, how does that affect you now? How do you think about that?
I've long had a sort of complicated history with not just mood-altering substances, but the issues around them. One of the reasons that I am so fond of David Simon did a series called The Corner, which was followed by The Wire. And I think he did a really good job of explaining, if we drive by a drug corner, I was in the Tenderloin last night, and you could see, you know, open-air drug sales. You assume everybody came to that corner the same way, and everybody's going to leave that corner in the same way, when in fact, there's all kinds of motivations on that corner, and there are people who are trying to toe touch, get enough money to keep the wheels on at home and go on and do other things. And there are other people who are out and out gangsters and have the drug lifestyle baked into their nature. And I don't think it's safe to assume that just because somebody gets involved with narcotics that they're a certain kind of person, one way or the other.
Getting back to the entire race element of it, how do you view that now?
Well, it's a combination of race and class factors. I'm against mandatory minimums. I'm glad that federal sentencing has now been handed back to judges. I think having a judicial system that's built on sentencing that could have been handled by a monkey in a robe and a 10-key calculator was a dumb way to go. I do think that one of the things that you have to understand is, at the same time, my bottom was cushioned. At some point, you do have to make an affirmative decision on your own behalf. And I do think that, let's say if you reproduce and their mother can't take care of them, to step up and take custody of those kids, that isn't a black or white thing. That's a human thing. And I thought I was saving them or looking after them. And in essence, they were really saving me.
And when they saw that in the book, did they know that that was your feeling? Or was that a surprise to either of them?
They didn't seem surprised by anything in the book. I think that they were, I mean, part of the gist of the book was they had done essays for college, and the story that they told and remembered was somewhat different than I did. I mean, Megan was one, who's one of my daughters, was one of the best interviews in the book. At the end, we talked over a bunch of things that had happened. And I, like any, you know, working journalist would say, I at the end, I said, well, is there anything else we should talk about? And she said, yeah, let's talk about you doing this book. I said, okay, let's talk about me doing this book. And she said, well, I just never thought you were the kind of person that would write a book like this. And I said, why is that? And she said, I didn't think you'd find catharsis in it. And she was right.
And did you?
No.
You have not found catharsis in it.
I found incredible artistic, journalistic joy in doing it. And I'm enormously proud of the book. And if you sort of look about, we're at the paperback now, but the hardcover got just about every sort of break you can get. I got, you know, a fairy tale ride. But in sort of reporting it, I sort of went after myself as another subject, writing it same way. Now that I'm living it, I wouldn't describe it as catharsis, but I would say it's profoundly uncomfortable. You have to keep in mind, when it came out, it was excerpted on the front of the Times magazine. So I went to work one day as a normal guy, and the next day there were six of my mugshots on the New York Times magazine. And, you know, it was a little different elevator ride than it had been in the past.
It sounds kind of schizophrenic. David Carr walking into a room, whether you feel like you're the subject or the author, and the subject and the author, in essence, are almost two different people.
I hadn't heard it put that way, but it neatly describes the bifurcation of my existence. One of the things, part of the problem is when you're a newspaper person, when I first started to read the book, I walked in someplace and somebody said, here comes the author, and I turned around and looked along with everybody else, because this is just my idea of a book. I didn't really view it as like a real book, and then people started treating it as a real book. I mean, one thing that's been a surprise on tour is you open up a vein this large and you do an investigation. I'm sure it could have been deeper and more rigorous, but it's a significant one. People always think there must be more. There must be something else.
There is, but a lot of that, as you said before, is that if you don't remember something as important to you, then there is more, but is it important?
Nobody said anything to me about the book that has changed my mind about, in the sort of foreword or descriptor for the book, I say, not every word in this book is clinically true, but it's as true as I can make it. I'm really moved off that. Nobody's come up to me and said anything like that I shaved a corner or pulled a stick out of the pile. One of the things that happened to me when I sent the book to my oldest brother, who I admire a great deal, and he said this, you know, there's violence against women in this book, and you and I know those were complicated relationships with complicated people who had their own issues with violence. I said, well, if I try and cut this corner, if I try and pull that stick out of the pile and somehow justify it, then the whole conceit of the book just sort of falls apart.
The conceit of the book in that sense is David Carr being brutal on himself.
Right. And I do think we all tend to sort of contextualize as we go. So everything we do seems explainable or understandable in the context of events, when in fact what you might be looking at is straight up pathology, narcissism, self-interest. And you don't really want to explain yourself by saying, well, maybe I was clinically a jerk, but in fact, many times that's the answer.
The title, The Night of the Gun, refers to when you pull a gun on a friend of yours, and it's never clear to you, was there a gun? Was there not a gun? Apparently there was a gun. You have no memory of there being a gun. You have no memory of there being a place for a gun. Since that time, has any memory come back about the gun?
Well, I mean, it was an important story for me because it was in sort of the way I remembered my past. I was such a bag of snakes one night. I went over to a friend of mine's house that he had to pull a gun to make me go away. And 20 years later, I went to see him. I described this terrible night that he ended up pulling a gun on me. And he listened to the whole story. And at the end of it, he said, you know, I think you actually had a gun. And I'd never thought of myself as a person who would carry a weapon, and so it didn't go with anything I knew. But further investigation from somebody extremely credible realized that it sort of revealed that yes, I did have a gun. This guy knew where I kept it. I've come to believe that what they said was true. It doesn't really change the fact that if you hand me a handgun right now, I wouldn't know what to do with it, and it would really scare me to be in the presence of it.
But you have absolutely no memory, even today, after you've been told that. Nothing came back to you to tell you that you had the gun?
As I wrote in the book, when he started to talk about the wooden box, where it was in my closet, at the address it was, yes, it rang distant alarming bells, but nothing more.
Well, David Carr, before we talk a little bit about your work at the Times and what's going on now, one more question. How does working on this book, do you think, change your own perception of you as a reporter, how you do interviews, or your own perception of journalism itself?
Well, I think that we all know that eyewitness testimony is only that and nothing more, and that people saying they saw something doesn't really change it. I can remember reporting on 9/11 and having a guy say to me, you know, the bottom half of the North Tower was totally obscured in dust. And then 2 minutes later, he told me somebody had jumped off the building and landed on a fireman. I thought, well, either the bottom half was obscured and you couldn't see, or you saw this guy land on another guy. But both things can't be simultaneously true. So I had my own sort of take on that. One of the things that I've learned, and this is more about the book, from the book tour than the book itself, but I did a lot of interviews for the book, and Jill Abramson, who's the managing editor at the Times, told me sort of doing this book would make me a better reporter. And one of the things that happened to me is there were two kinds of media opportunities. One was somebody would call me up and make a little speech about why I did the book, what context it falls into, what my motivation was, and what their take was, and then they might ask me some questions. And there were many other people who just showed up and began asking questions. No speech, no take, no nothing. I've always been the first kind. I've always been the guy that's going to tell you what your story is about before we even begin talking. And I think I've become a lot less prone toward having a take on something. Over and over, the people who just did, as you're doing or as many journalists do, just asking questions, continuing to ask questions. Like, I got interviewed by this guy at the Oregonian the other day. I haven't seen this story, but I can tell you it's going to be a wonderful story because all he did was ask question after question after question. And it didn't matter if he had a take to start. I'm sure he had a take when he was done.
Now, David Carr, how did you get involved specifically in business reporting? Was that what you were hired for? And how did you become the bagger for the Oscars?
Those are related stories. When I was working at Washington City Paper, which is an alternative weekly in Washington, D.C., you know, much like Bay Guardian or SF Weekly or Chicago Reader or any of those. And I was brought up to New York to work for a website started by Deanna Brown, Kurt Anderson, and Michael Hirshhorn called Inside.com that was web-only publishing. And I had been reporting on the site about the media, but when I got there, and it was an interesting room, you know, you had people from the Wall Street Journal, from McSweeney's, from all over the map, all arrayed over covering this sort of convergent media that we are beginning to live. And while I was doing that, I ended up covering publishing in a more business-like way. So I got hired as a magazine publishing reporter at the New York Times, and then I became a general assignment reporter covering movies, music, television. And they had a media column come up and asked me if I want to write about the media. And I think this is in 2003 or 4, and I said, I'm really tired of writing about the media. They always say that the sky is falling and nothing ever changes. And finally, my friends at the paper said, don't be an idiot. How many columns at the New York Times do you think you're going to be offered? You just go ahead and do it. And, of course, immediately after I started doing the column, large chunks of the sky began falling every which way in all different ways. And one of the things that happened is our readers became producers of their own. They could sort of decide in what way they wanted to consume content. So when the subject of doing a blog about the Oscars came up, I was hired mostly because of my web expertise, because I had worked at Inside.com. I loved movies, but I didn't know anything about the Oscars. And so I began making, not only doing daily dispatches, but doing weekly videos as well.
the reports from The Bagger, comparing them to other reports on the Oscars, you seem to have a pretty good idea, and I wonder if it just comes from your own background as a journalist, maybe even from your life, the difference between perception and reality, which is difficult to grasp in a place like Hollywood, and in a lot of articles, some of them in the New York Times, by others, that line seems to blur.
You know, a lot of times people have said to me, people who like the work I did on the Oscars or like the work that I did about movies, says, you should move to L.A. You should cover that industry. I could tell you with the certainty that 6 months after I got there, I would not have changed the way that that town was covered. That town would have changed me. I think the entertainment industry is very badly behaved in press matters and feels as if they own the coverage, and it's a privilege for them to allow you to access to talk to Gwyneth Paltrow or to spend time with Mickey Rourke, that you should feel grateful and you should just carry water. I've never bought into that transaction, and I worry that if I lived in L.A., that gradually, like some invisible poison gas, it would seep into my head, and I'd begin writing and talking like a robot.
It's funny when you say that, because it reminds me of something Molly Ivins said years ago when I interviewed her, that the Beltway is the same way. And once she spent a couple of weeks in the Beltway, after 2 weeks, she said the poison of the Beltway had done the same thing to her, and she was beginning to think in Beltway speak, and she had to get back to Austin to just recuperate.
Yeah, well, I think that Molly makes a great point, and it's arrayed over two cultures that are almost exactly the same, which is they're extremely hierarchical. If we talk Washington and Los Angeles, single industry town built on serving power. Every important person has a gaggle of 10 people coming behind them, a posse, and they are continually reinforced of their own excellence and importance. And I think the fact that I spent time in Washington prepared me well for sort of the fear-based culture that goes on in L.A. That doesn't mean there aren't great people doing great things, and I'm a frantic, frantic movie fan. But once you pull back the blankets on it and you see the furnace of ego and ambition and neediness that produces America's software, which is entertainment, you know, it's sort of breathtaking to behold.
Last summer, David Carr, you wrote a column about Fox News. There's a comment you made. Fox News' amazing coup d'etat in the cable news war has been undercovered, and you state the reason it's undercovered is because of the way they play with access. And I think that it's not just Fox News, it's all of Washington. What Fox News was doing or is doing is exactly what the Bush administration had done, and the result is that if people are fighting for access, what winds up happening is all they wind up doing is kissing ass.
Right, and I do think that you end up sort of being held prisoner or hostage. The fact that I grew up in alternative newspapers helped me, because a lot of times people would not talk to me until I had them absolutely up against the wall and say, I'm going to push the button on this, you can take the call or not. I do think that you can get confused into thinking that just because you've spent time talking ahead of, say, the Appropriations Committee or a junior studio head, that you've somehow been brought in close. Those are your fake friends. Those aren't your real friends. As soon as your last name is not New York Times, they will kick you to the curb and drop you like a box of rocks. You know, people show a great deal of interest in who I am in certain industries, but it derives precisely from the fact that I have my hands on this big megaphone. It isn't because they find me charming or winning as a person.
And they can also deny you access, but then they lose the New York Times.
They lose the New York Times, and in the instance of Fox, that game they were playing, which is striking fear into the heart of anybody that would write about them, and they had an entire sort of industry that was covering media back on their heels. In that column, I'm really happy that I just stepped right up, hit them right on the kisser, and you know what? I've had a great relationship with them ever since. It's been very easy to call them and work with them. And
well, what if you wind up writing a column? Not that you will, but what if you write up a column on the way that Fox people, like O'Reilly, for example, or Glenn Beck, produce hate speech, which winds up roiling the masses so that Well, you know the whole story of what they're talking about.
I did a story about their tax revolt and sort of the manufactured consent that they put out there. And they engaged to a certain degree on it. I mean, you know, Fox has a huge audience, but let's say I did that story. What will happen is the next night I might end up on O'Reilly. My picture will run, and they'll say, David Carr, a known crackhead from the New York Times, suggested that. And I think to myself, it's sort of true. So, I mean, it leaves his readers mystified because they have no idea really what he's talking about. I mean, running a picture of me is not like running a picture of Maureen Dowd or somebody like that. You know what I mean? But they will settle scores when they need to.
But at the same time, as long as you have some kind of access, you don't care if they call you all kinds of names. Or do you?
Well, I don't need access to do my job. I do think that much of what you need to know lies in plain sight. You know, I think we forget as the media, mainstream media suffers and some of it tumbles, the amount of power that has sort of gone to the reporter's desktop in terms of access, not just to real time, but archival data about what everybody has said or done. And you have the ability to work with databases from your desktop that I think give you such a much longer memory, if you will, as a reporter and allow you to step into things with a lot more sort of forcefulness.
So the old he said, she said kind of journalism that we're seeing throughout the media, which puts a lie and a truth on an equal plane, that's absolutely not necessary, and that's just laziness.
You know, it's hard to say. I always worked under the assumption that truth is the hole in the middle of the donut, but more and more I'm thinking it's probably on the donut somewhere. And I think that the web and blogging in particular, and let's eliminate the sort of signal to noise that's out there and the amount of trolls who are just dealing in invective. And I've never found it to have a political correlate. I think there's as many low-sloping foreheads on the left as there are on the right, and their rhetoric is no better. There is, I think, a tendency today to try and drive towards some kind of conclusion in this rolling organic dialogue that is, you know, news is a living thing now. Like, for instance, CNN didn't pay enough mind to the Iranian elections, didn't cover them wall to wall. It was going crazy on Twitter, just frantic. And that was not me stepping in on Monday and saying, well, CNN apparently took a pass this weekend, blah, blah, blah. This was thousands and perhaps millions of people saying, this is something we want. Where are you? And CNN was compelled to respond on Twitter, elsewhere, and in their programming as well.
Do you think that Twitter is going to make or has made that kind of change in how the news is covered now?
I think that Twitter is going to be a fairly sticky application, partly because the followers become an asset, and unless you can port those to somewhere else, unless that becomes immediately movable to somewhere else, it's going to keep you stuck. When the next big thing comes along, I would be very reluctant to leave behind the 6,000 followers I have on Twitter.
David Carr, one other thing you've been covering a lot lately is what's been happening to newspapers and magazines, that the New York Times apparently will survive okay, at least till, I think you said, 2011 or 2012. The Boston Globe is basically worthless. Refugees from the Star Ledger, Newark Star Ledger, have given up on getting paid for their journalism. And you also quote David Simon of The Wire as saying, high-end journalism can and should bite any hand that tries to feed it. And it should bite a government hand most viciously, which kind of indicates that government bailouts of newspapers are not the answer either. Where do you think it's all going?
You know, I used to be very prone to speeches when the subject of the future of newspapers came up. And I knew, in fact, at the beginning of the year that major metropolitan papers were going to close. But the ferocity and velocity of this story has surpassed my ability to sort of understand. I do see the industry bifurcating into large national brands, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, and then, oddly enough, the community papers, I don't know if you've noticed, are doing very, very well. The closer you are to the customers, the better you do. The mid-range metropolitan papers had the most exposure to Craigslist. I'm seeing Craig this afternoon, Craig Newmark, the founder But what he did, someone else would have come up. So 40% of their business got taken out. And then you have auto and housing craters behind it. So you have both the secular change in which insurgent threats attempt to overthrow you, whether you want it or not. And then you have this cycle we're in where two big feeders of newspaper advertising, auto and housing, have just gone to heck. So it's tough to see where it will stop. I live in New Jersey, and I've watched Star Ledger get smaller every day.
Where is the Star Ledger now?
Well, I mean, it's still coming out all the time, but it's not. They built a robust, wonderful paper, built it up over many years, and now they're in the process of tearing out the arms and legs of it. And as you pointed out, I wrote a couple weeks ago how people, refugees from there, have started NewJerseyNewsroom.com to kick up.
Do you think that the future of journalism may well lie in volunteer reportage? I mean, is that what we're coming to, where you make a living doing something else and then you're a newsman on the side?
Well, I think my mortgage banker would be sad if that were the case. It isn't so much that reporting is an incredibly arcane and difficult profession that other people can't master. It's that it takes time and that you have to stay with it over and over.
That's the thing that's most lost, I think, is that, sure, you can do what AP does or you could get on, look up something, but if you want to write a serious investigative piece, that's going to take a long period of time, and it would be a shame if the only place you'll see it is the occasional New York Times article or the New Yorker, because that ignores local issues.
Yeah, well, to me, even the run-of-mill daily in a metropolitan story, very difficult. It's got the access issues that you brought up. Who are you going to call? Are they going to take your phone call? Can you use existing databases to find out what you want, or do you have to pick up the phone, which many bloggers just have an allergy to picking up that telephone? I mean, when people write about us and cheer on the demise of newspapers, I always say, well, you know how this ends. It ends with you being stuck with nothing to write about. You know, if you can't annotate what we do, you're going to have to pick up the phone yourself. Are you really ready for that?
People, I think, get the idea of just being able to be on the web. They don't want that interpersonal contact that a phone call makes, but you have to do that.
I have my own allergy to the telephone as a reporter, and I a lot of times have to force myself onto the phone. And I find myself spending hours and hours trying to find out something on the web where if I would just pick up the phone, dial the number, and ask someone, I experienced this yesterday. I got my answer right away.
David Carr, now Night of the Gun has come out in paperback. The website is up and running, and it's an enormous website, nightofthegun.com. Do you plan to work on another book? That's the first question. The other one is, having done the book, are you more honest with yourself now than you used to be?
In terms of getting started on another book, I think the media story right now, which is I write this Monday media column, you know, I do some other cultural stuff, I think that's absolutely preoccupying because of how fast the story is moving. I think it would be a bad time to try and step out and write a book. I also think it would be a mistake to look at this situation in which newspapers and some brands of mainstream news seem to be dying off and think that if you wrote a book about that, anybody would care. I don't think they would. I don't think you should write a big tome about attenuating interest in a particular thing and expect people to pick it up. So that's one thing. In terms of, is one of the sort of outcomes of the book is that I'm more direct or more honest with myself. I think I was pretty much going in. I mean, part of what I did was I had sober for 14 years and then I tried drinking again. And, you know, that didn't go so well. It ended up in handcuffs for me. And so since then, which was like 6 months before I started the book, it was kind of like an idea of trying to remember. I think I've been fairly direct. I mean, there's no real mystery for me about what happens if I get involved in mood-altering chemicals. And I do, in the course of listening to people as a reporter, try and understand that their own needs are baked into every story that they tell.
David Carr, what do you think the media story will be? When this airs, what do you think the story is going to be?
We're going to be looking at a municipal area that's not losing its second paper, but its first. And we're going to be looking hard at what's going to happen, what is going to replace that in creating accountability for city officials, for what's going to reflect the broader culture. I do think that we're going to have to see coming behind the collapse of, you know, newspapers are not just newspapers. They're huge newsrooms all over the country. What models are going to come in behind that? That's going to be the story, I think, going forward for this year and next.
You've been listening to an interview with David Carr, whose memoir, The Night of the Gun, is now out in trade paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.